Well, thank you for inviting me to this seminar, this symposium. Through my relationship with Dow, through the developing Cordiopan central nervous system, I come to know many great entomologists with Dow, and Larry Larson is certainly one of them, and I'm very honored to be a last speaker of this symposium here. The risk of being the last speaker is that somebody have a potential to steal your thunder, and it's happened, so I have to kind of repair my damage as I go along, I guess. There are two parts in my talk. One is how universities identify and protect our intellectual property. The other is how do we transfer that technology to the private industry through this collaborative relationship. So let me talk about the first part of it. There's different type of intellectual property. Most of you probably know the patent, but there are many other as well. Copyright, know-hows, trade secret, very famous one is Coca-Cola. It's almost stolen 2 years ago, but I think it's still safe. The last one is trademark. And the trademark is a very famous one of this one coming from university arena is Gatorade. Okay. Many of you probably know Gatorade. University of Florida made a lot of money through Gatorade, but we don't have a patent. Actually, there's no patent for Gatorade at all. There's only trademark. We don't even own the trademark. Somebody else does it, but we make money out of it. So this is a very interesting story with Gatorade when you try to think about how universities deal with its intellectual property. So let me start my talk with this tale of Gatorade before 1980s. And this one probably can tell you intellectual property policy or the lack thereof at the university levels before 1980. Now Gatorade story start with Dr. Robert Cade. He's a kidney expert from the University of Florida's School of Medicine. He and the trio of his fellows started this Gatorade formulation because one of his research fellow was a friend of the assistant coach of football team, Gators. And the assistant coach asked him one day why his football player don't go wee-wee after practice. That's exact quote, okay? And not just that they don't go to urinate, but also they sometimes pass out from the heat exhaustion and the performance drop after practice. So they hypothesize that not just they are losing water, but they're also probably losing a lot of other things when they sweat. So the idea here is to find out what did they lose, and if you can put it back to their body, maybe they can perform better. Okay, so that's where the idea comes from. They try to put the electrolyte back into the system. Now, initially, of course, when they approached the football coach at the University of Florida, that football coach did not allow Dr. Cade to use the varsity team player for testing. So he had to use freshman only. And, you know, poor freshman, not only they had to be drink this awful drink, it tastes pretty bad at the beginning, but they also have to have them blood drawn, urine tested, and if they have any after practice, and then, you know, they have the temperature taken. But the only thing they wouldn't allow them to do is to take absolute temperature. It's take temperature from rectum. They wouldn't let them do that. Anyway, but it's really kind of interesting that things are happening. Because these freshmen have to drink this awful drink, they perform better than the varsity team. They say, oh, there's something, maybe something up here. So in the season 1966, from the get on, the football coach say, okay, prepare a whole bunch of them and everybody drink it. So now, when they have to do that, because, well, Dr. K did not have any bucket at all. Not silver, not pink, not green. He's using his own pocket money to do this, okay? He's absolutely using money, so he's running out his money. So he offered University of Florida $10,000 the right to University of Florida. University of Florida say, nobody drink that awful thing. Forget about it. They reject it. Well, interesting thing happened is that season, Gator did very well. By the mid-season, we are 6-0, which never heard of before that. Okay? In the seventh game, it's a big game. Gators against Georgia Bulldog. We play in Jacksonville. So Dr. K and his fellow prepare a whole bunch of Gatorade drink, put in the truck, supposed to be driving to Jacksonville. Well, didn't make it. for whatever reason, only that game they did not have a Gatorade and they lost. Whoop. And according to Dr. Cade, the truck was driving from the highway to Jacksonville and it was hijacked by Blue Dog student. Well, I don't know if it's true or not, but that's what he said. Anyway, Gators finished very well that year, 9-2, including we won a bowl game. And then some reporters started to realize, well, of course, another reason could be we have this guy over there, Steve Spurrier. He was a quarterback that year. And that could be a reason. And he claimed that he never drank Gatorade, by the way. He only drank Coke. But some reporters started to realize and linked Gatorade with the winning streak. And it says the report in the Miami Herald said that Gatorade tastes like a mint, which is a lie. It doesn't taste like a mint at all. It works like a miracle. But according to Mrs. K, it was her idea because it tastes so bad that, you know, it's her idea to squeeze the lemon into this drink and put a little sugar in there to create like a lemonade type of, a taste. So because of that, they call it Gatorade. Okay, that's where the name comes from. Lemonade drink by Gators. Now, so this is Dr. K in much later days and with his original lemon drink stuff. Now, because University of Florida did not want it, some of the people surrounding Dr. K decided they better do something about this thing. Looks like it has some commercial potential, if there's any. So they formed a company called Gatorade Inc. And one of the person within this group happened to know a lawyer, his friend, a lawyer, in Orlando. So he put $500 out of his own pocket, secured a patent, tried to apply for a patent, also secured a name called Gatorade. And they eventually licensed this entire thing to Starkley Van Camp in Indianapolis. Now, Starkley is a food company, very good in marketing. They began to market it to college sports team, eventually to NFL, NBA, and so on and so forth in a later day. But you can remember this Michael Jordan's Gatorade commercial, very famous one. But when they're doing this in 1967, started moving into college football team, a lot of interesting things started happening here. And this is the genius of the marketing scheme, even today being taught in the MBA school. Well, soccer didn't push a lot, but they only make sure that some sports team will have Gatorade drink on the sideline. So for example, in one of the big game of the year, 1967, was Notre Dame upset by Purdue. Okay, Notre Dame was the number one rank in 1967, upset. Well, happened to be Purdue, being near to Indianapolis, have some of the alumni working for Starkley. So they have a free sample of Gatorade on the sideline. Now, Notre Dame coach have this lost the game, he had to blame something. So he said, that's it, Gatorade, that's had to be it. We lost the game because we did not have a Gatorade. From now on, we are gonna have Gatorade on our bench as well. Now this thing repeated still many times in many teams, and then Gatorade started mushrooming all over. Not to mention, they only make sure that Gatorade bucket with a big sign on the sideline and cup and everything, that create a lot of interesting thing going on. For example, one of the is this, you know, Victory Gatorade bath. If somebody started this one here, and then Starkley will tell you they didn't do anything to promote this, but somebody started, everybody doing it, and you know, you can see what's happening, right? At the end of big game, millions of people in front of TV, what they can see is a big orange bucket with Gatorade sign on it. What is a free commercial for them, okay? When this thing going on and Gatorade start making money, oh my God. Some reporters start to realize the inventor of Gatorade is Dr. K, professor at the University of Florida. So did University of Florida get any money at all? So you ask Dr. K, did University of Florida get anything? He said, no, they didn't, because they said they didn't want to. Whoop. Not a very good story. But for newspaper people, that's a juicy scandal. Oh my God, everybody started writing the story all over. Now, the success prompted media attention over the public missed opportunity to get an income from Gatorade. So there's a newspaper article all over. For example, St. Petersburg Times say, I saw it called Gatorade, the success that ran away. Very sensational. The Orlando Sentinel say, who really own Gatorade? That they become such a scandal, the University of Florida has to somehow respond to this one here. They have to make something to say, oh, well, you know, we didn't really say no, because it's verbally, there's no document say no. And to the point that in 1968, Florida State Attorney's Office did an investigation. Now, this really embarrassed a lot, University of Florida. And president even come up and say, what's going on? Nobody know what's going on. So, now, when this thing happened, now NIH claimed, no. U.S. government owned the patent because $42 of the $80,000 they give to Dr. K was spent on a small amount of chemical, radioactive chemical, he used to test, to trace the movement of the chemical in a rat. So they have to own the entire thing, okay? Now, this thing going on, and Dr. K was totally upset about this entire thing. He's commented, well, it used to be very fun. When the money coming in, it's not fun anymore. So he said, listen, I have a 70% of the Gatorade Trust. University of Florida, you have it. I don't want any of those things. University of Florida rejected again. They said, no, we want 100%. Whoop. Anyway, that's what a story, huh? This is the reason why we need a policy, right? Now, Gatorade Trust finally say, that's it. They file a motion against the university and say, you have to give out the right because he's rejected. Well, the next year, university filed a countersuit against the trust and stopped and said, no, university owned the damn thing. Because he invented this one when he was a professor, he used the resource university to do that. Not only that, the success of Gatorade owned primarily to the name, Gators. That is an athletic team. That is the reason why they are successful. That's the argument, okay? Now, this thing going on for quite a while, and Dr. K, according to Dr. K's family, during this time was very unhappy. He just, at one point, he tried to quit the job because all his associates already left. They went to somewhere else. He's the only one defending himself at the University of Florida. He get a lot of pressure at the university. Finally, in 1972, settled because we have this nice congressman called Paul Rogers. He's a congressman from Palm Beach, and he happened to be a chairman of subcommittee of U.S. Congress, a subcommittee for health and environment. And he put all parties together in his office in Washington, D.C., and he asked everybody to sign, agree on the certain condition. Number one, NIH required that Dr. K had to publish a result. If they publish it, that's fine with NIH. They don't have any quarrel with that. But because the result will be published before patent is issued, they have to abandon the patent. So Gatorade have no patent, actually. We have no patent. This is public knowledge. All the formulation, everybody knows. You can copy it if you want to. But NIH allows Stockley to keep Gatorade trademark, okay? University of Florida, we received 20% royalty. And by then, none of the people with Gatorade Inc. have any stomach to fight any father. Everybody just signed it. And just like, forget it. No, we don't want 20%, you take it, whatever. Well, University of Florida was really still very unhappy. Only 20%? We should get more. That's the attitude, basically, okay? But if you think about it, between 1972 and 2004, University of Florida received over $100 million from the 20% royalty. That's how much they make. And this is one of the most successful stories of IP from any university. And still being copied, try to be copied today. Now, finally, I guess University of Florida recognized Dr. K was a good guy at all, so they gave him an honorary alumnus award. And this he was awarded in the halftime into the end of the game. And he's my hero, by the way, so I always wanted to meet him. Our office technology licensing did not even know I never met him before. So he was really surprised when I told him them that. So they are arranging a meeting this year in March in Gainesville that he and I are supposed to share the stage, and we are each of us supposed to give a talk. And unfortunately, he passed away November last year, 2007, and this is last year's picture. But I have honored to meet with family, and now the family is trying to create a museum in Gainesville in honor of him. It's Discovery and Invention Museum in honor of Dr. Case. So this is the story of Gatorade, and I keep using the word, put this one, 1980s, and by now, somebody has stolen my thunder here, so you know what the significance of 1980s, right? Well, it's a Bayh-Dole Act, 1980s. Before the Bayh-Dole Act, before this, you know, U.S. government have over 30,000 patent through funded research, but less than 5% are licensed. And there's no unified patent policy, pretty much agency by agency, case by case, okay? What Bayh-Dole Act did is that it granted universities, small business, and non-profit organizations to retain the title of the intellectual property result from federally funded project. And also, like my previous speaker said, U.S. government also retained a margin right to license the invention to third party without paying a fee at all, although they never exercised this one. But what it does is that it kind of threatened them, if you don't do it, we will do it type of thing, okay? So in fact, what the Bayh-Dole Act is that it recognizes that academic research by university is critical to the nation's innovation and R&D capacity. By doing put this marching right in there, it obligates university to proactively protect the market and market their technology, or else potentially they can forfeit them to the federal funding agency. Since then, more than 260 university TLO technology licensing offices have been created, and this have stimulated a lot of research, industrial productivity, innovation in the United States. Now, this also gives authority to each state, authority to have your own statute to protect intellectual property at each Grand and Grand University at the state. And based on that, this statute we have in Florida, university have our own intellectual property policy. And this is a little booklet of the policy there. I love this booklet because there's a real nice looking guy over there. And it's basically require all University of Florida personnel to disclose potential IPs while affiliated with University of Florida. Basically, in nutshell, what I say is that University of Florida only employ invention when the invention was made while he or she was employed at the UF, and the invention is in the field discipline in which he or she was employed, or the invention was made with university resources. Remember, it's the employee, doesn't say professor or anything. So anybody can do it. If you're a janitor employed by University of Florida, find a better way to clean your bathroom and try to patent the University of Florida on it too. Okay. So we ask our people to disclose, then we go through the interview, and interview process, basically we're looking for the patentability, have been novel, useful, and non-obvious. But just because it can be patented, many things fall into this category, you really don't have to do it, okay? Because it costs a lot of money, okay? Because there's thing called marketability, all right? If you don't make money, you really don't want to patent that. Now, because University of Florida, when they file the patent, we pay about $25,000 per patent. That's a lot of money. This is between 1999 to 2007, the white bar is the number of disclosure over the years. It's pretty much doubles. You can see the yellow bar is patent file, and green bar is licensed. So between this year, after about 1,900 disclosure, we are very generous. 87% of them have been patented. That's cost the University of Florida $42 million just to file those patents. Okay? But of those 1,700 patents, only 452 are licensed. That's about 27%. So despite this very nice internal review, and we are paying this much money, only 27% of IP has been licensed, and even fewer is generating any income. My estimate is less than 5% of IP generated more than 90% of royalty income at the University of Florida. And I'm very generous on this one, okay? The real figure is probably even worse than this. Anyway. So most granted patents are either not licensed or not generating any income. So reason why? Why is that? To understand this, we've got to go back to this issue here, my second issue, which is how do we collaborate with the commercial partner to transfer the technology? Now, we have two entities here, university and industry. You have a different mission. University mission is create and disseminate knowledge. Industry is to maximize investment to the shareholder. As a result of that, university have a problem here. Our research agenda is not set by marketplace place, and we don't quite understand what industry really need in the business sense. Well, problem in industry is that lack of patient risk capital and committed champions. But I really cannot blame them for that. Look at this structure here, the cost structure to bring a concept, from concept all the way to the commercial production takes about 3 to 10 years, about $500,000 to $20 million, and university cover about 10% of that. 90% have to be covered by the industry, okay? That 90% cost share makes the industry a very prudent and reluctant partner. As a result of that, we have a value of death of the early stage technology, meaning they just die, because nobody wanna commit to it, right? So, let's drill this one a little farther here, and somebody will touch base on this one here, I'm not gonna get into much. Pros and cons of this kind of relationship. Of course, if you can share, if commercial partner can share with me your real world problem, perhaps I can solve it, but I don't understand. You don't share with me. You know, you tend to be very secretive about it. And we can even share the resource too if you want to. I can get money from somewhere, we can share that and share, but you have to share the problem with me. And that, you know, if you do that, there's a lot of pro can happen. Cons. There's three type of problem I can identify. One is the problem between university and commercial partner, okay? The other one is university and research community. Often we say, because we have to protect IP, it interferes with free open exchange idea at the research university. University and public problem. Most of the grant universities are paid by taxpayers. If you give exclusive licensing to one party, that's a hurt consumer and taxpayers. How gonna answer that question? Let's deal with this one by one. Share technology know-how and trade secret. I don't think it's such a difficult thing. You can spell our licensing in the agreement and make sure that we protect the our partner trade secret and know-how. Now, I understand perfectly the university researchers tend to have what we call foot in the mouth disease, also known as the vice president, who is that? Joe Biden disease, but that disease can be cured easily if we know there's a serious consequence at the end when you open your mouth, right? So you can spill it out and keep your zip, okay? Ownership of IP, sometimes if you do a lot of research together, now who own that IP? Well, co-own it. If you file the patent, in the eyes of patent law, co-inventor is one of the inventor. It doesn't matter you're the first one, the last one. It's all shared together, it will solve the problem. I don't see any reason why we cannot share that. So this kind of thing is solvable if we understand where we are, okay? Now the problem in the research community, this criticism that somehow is interference with the free and open exchange idea among university researchers, well, in my humble opinion, is greatly exaggerated. We can spell out an agreement for the right to publish after a certain period, and we do this all the time. What's really important thing is that university need to understand the industry need to protect its IP, but industry need to also understand our mission in dissemination of knowledge. We cannot just do some study and let it sit on the shelf forever. Give it some time, we'll let you do what you want to do, but let us publish. That is really, really important. Understanding? Okay. And you see, this thing can be said, and we do this all the time, even for the basic research. Most of the researchers will often ensure publishing results before even openly present or discuss with the other researchers. Not just because we are immoral or anything, we learn this from our mistake. When I was a graduate student, I was openly freely talking with anybody on my idea, and very soon I find out somebody wrong with the idea of mine. And he said, "Oop, you can't do that." You know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. See, I just complete a sentence that George W. couldn't Anyway, so you just have to, you know, secure your publication before you open the mouth. So same thing can be applied for the idea of commercial potential. Secure a patent or any other instrument you have, secure intellectual property right, then discuss you want. That is so simple. I don't think there's any problem at all here. Now, it's true, the problem, are we hurting consumer taxpayer when they give exclusive licensing and to only one party? Yeah, this is a real tough one. I mean, you know, oftentimes I've been criticized of this from my university researcher many times because of the, you know, centric on everything else. But you have to understand, and this is the word to my fellow university researcher though, more than 90% of the total cost has to be covered by the commercial partner. That's number one. Number two, not all the investment by the commercial partner result in positive payback. How many times a Syngenta or Dow will contact with university, and how many times they actually have some positive, something commercial, you know, marketable stuff coming out? 1 out of 10, maybe? If it's 1 out of 10, now your 90% become 99%. No, 910, well, 10 divided by 910 is less than 1% actually. So if you understand that exclusive license is really a little thing we can do to ensure the recovery of development cost invested by the commercial partner, very few, probably non-commercial partner, would take on a risk to invest the development cost without any adequate protection. We have to understand that. Okay? So alternative of that is to have the IP not being used, just sitting there. That's the alternative, basically. So in closing of my talk, let me quote Thomas Edison's words. Edison said, "The value of an idea lies in the using of it. If not being used, it's useless. It's useless not being used. Perhaps our very important mission of disseminating, dissemination of knowledge is not being performed." Thank you very much.